You're listening to Further Faster in association with Montane, the podcast that asks ultra athletes, mountaineers, and explorers the why and the how.
Hello, and welcome to Further Faster in association with Montane. My name is Daniel Nielsen, and in these podcasts, I talk to ultra athletes, explorers, and mountaineers to discover how they do what they do and why they do what they do. So in this episode, I speak to Damien Hall. You've probably come across him before. He's a journalist. He's an ultra runner. He's also positioned highly in the Montane Spine Race and the Ultra Tour de Mont Blanc. In fact, the last time he did it, it became the subject of a film called Underdog that won an award at the recent Kendall Mountain Festival. And most recently, with Beth Pascal, he also achieved the fastest known time of the Cape Wrath Trail. He's also a lovely bloke. So in this podcast, we talk about his training, about team dynamics, and also running 26 miles dressed as a toilet. There's some other serious stuff in there too. Listen in. Okay, so here I am with Damien Hall. Damien's, how would you describe yourself, Damien?
How would I describe myself? Oh, gosh. Gap-toothed, balding, skinny, midlife crisis runner.
Brilliant. Okay. That sounds, that's just on brand for our podcast. So that's okay. but you write as well. You do an awful lot of running and you run a lot of distances. Do other two linked? Did you get into journalism through running or vice versa? Or how are they kind of parallel lives that never mix?
No, they have mixed a lot in the last few years. I suppose I started off as a journalist first. After university, like a lot of people, I hadn't done a degree that led me anywhere.
What did you do?
I studied sociology.
Me too. There we go. Oh my gosh, our lives are except you run a lot further than I do. But yeah, our lives aren't that different. No, okay,
but that is funny. We've both ended up in a similar area that isn't obviously related to sociology.
No, I keep trying to sell myself that it is, but it's not.
Oh, well, nice one. I mean, I was genuinely interested in the subject, but it doesn't lead somewhere obvious. But towards the end of that, I was contemplating a PhD just simply because I was too frightened of making the leap into the real world. And at the last minute, I thought, actually, instead of writing a PhD, I could maybe write for, newspapers and magazines. Yep. And that maybe someone would actually, might actually read that occasionally.
More than a thesis or something.
But at the time I was nuts about football. And I was for about sort of 20 odd years. So I became a football journalist in about 2000. I got my first
job. I used to write for 442 magazine. Our lives are parallel.
No way. Yeah. My first job was at the 442 website.
Yeah. I had a blog on there. Oh, that's a good. Yeah, okay.
This is uncanny.
It is. This is uncanny. We genuinely don't know each other, but yeah.
Wow. That is, I don't know how many sociology graduates have worked for 442 for starters. Yeah, that's okay. It's quite strange. Who do you support?
Scunthorpe United.
Oh, okay.
But I had a blog about Argentinian football on the 442 with a really bad caricature that they did. That's what
nice.
I remember.
Oh, brilliant. From there, so I loved that job for a while, and then I got a bit, my sort of job changed a bit. I got a little bit bored, and I thought, time to go travelling. So I sort of went travelling around the world in about end of 2002, and that naturally led me to sort of travel journalism, I suppose. I ended up living in Sydney for 5 or 6 years and traveling in between. I was probably away from Britain for about 8 years in total. That travel journalism gradually morphed into what seems to be called sort of outdoor journalism. At the time I realized I love traveling, but I wanted to visit national parks and mountains and not necessarily cities and museums and cafes and hotels. They didn't excite me.
Sure.
And around that time also I got really into trekking, long distance walking.
I think you're me. This is like interviewing myself. Okay, go on.
We actually related, or possibly the same person.
Possibly the same.
We haven't been sitting in the same room together.
especially
visiting Argentina and New Zealand for the first time. Especially in New Zealand, I was just blown away by the scenery there, and they have all these wonderfully, as I'm sure you know, you've probably walked the same ones as me, the great walks there. They're really well organized and maintained, and signposted walks. that are just stunning, and that really got me into that and the whole outdoors attitude of Australia and New Zealand. And I lived in Sydney. I'd explore all the national parks nearby regularly. Really got into that. And then when it was time to kind of move back to Britain in 2010, I was still, I sort of looked at what I could do. I wanted to be freelance.
Yeah.
And I found the Outdoor Writers and Photographers Guild and thought, well, that's kind of close to what I want to do. So I'll call myself an outdoor journalist. And that started off being... I suppose I've done a little bit of mountaineering along the way, nothing too dramatic, but started off being a bit of mountaineering and made, you know, walking, writing about walking, hiking, trekking. And that's, but then in 2011, did my first half marathon, which I loved on the roads. The next year I was doing my first marathon, dressed as a toilet.
Okay. And we'll come back to that one. Yeah.
This is where the journalism first crosses with the running. Is that,
so I can see now, you pitched to somebody, so like, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it dressed as a toilet. Do you want an article? Is that...
Yes, I think something like... My biggest motivation was, obviously, to make a fool of myself, but secondarily, to raise money for WaterAid, and they offered you run as a tap or a toilet.
You obviously went for the toilet, or was the tap taken?
Of course. I mean, there's no choice there, is there?
There isn't. There really isn't. No.
Having people shouting, you look a bit flushed mate at you.
I guess that got a bit boring after 26 miles.
Yeah, the first 10 miles were fun. But and towards the end, I really needed the toilet and I couldn't find one. So that was quite a memorable experience, let's say. And then, so I pestered Outdoor Fitness, which was a new magazine at the time. And I said, you've got to let me write about, you know, my running experience so far. And they said, okay, but we're going to call your bluff and we're going to send you on your first ultra marathon.
Right. Okay.
So I agreed. You know what it's like. You pitch a story to a magazine and they sort of half accept. You sort of just got to say yes, haven't you? Especially if it's a new magazine for you. And then I thought, oh, well, I better go away and look at what an ultra marathon is. Turns out it's a bit longer than a marathon.
Yeah, just a little bit.
So later that yeah, it can be, later that year. So that summer 2012, I did a race called The Wall, which was 69 miles over 2 days. And just absolutely loved it. I mean, obviously it hurt a bit, but I loved the camaraderie and the scenery and I loved the sense of achievement. Also, the aid stations are brilliant. Just all these snacks you could just tuck into.
Without worrying about it.
Yeah. And then when it finished, I just straight away thought, this is for me. I want to do more of this. It's just, there's something about, I almost don't want to think about it too much, but there's something about my personality that just loves that sort of thing. Okay.
Well, we're going to delve into that a little bit as well. And then we're going to fast forward a little bit. Your most recent trail was also your most recent achievement was the Cape Wrath trail, which you did the fastest known time.
Yeah, so just in December 2018, me and my good friend Beth Pascal, who I've done a few races with and I know her fairly well, and is an incredible runner. You'd probably say she's Britain's, best female ultra runner, or sort of, or within the first top two, anyway.
We'll definitely have a run.
We'd been scheming with our good friends, actually, Matt and Ellie from Summit Fever Media. It was kind of their idea.
I was talking to them this morning. Yeah, this is okay.
You were what? You were talking to them?
Yeah, talking to Matt. Yeah. Anyway.
Too spooky. It was sort of their idea. They wanted to make a little film that was sort of a British winter adventure, and so we'd been talking about it for a good 18 months or more, and we didn't know of anyone who'd run it in the winter, so that seemed exciting. And then I suppose we looked into what the record was for covering it, you know, in one go.
Yeah.
and that seemed fairly don't mean to sound, you know, too cocky, but sort of it seemed fairly achievable to us, because I think the record was 7 days, seven and a half days roughly. So to us, that seemed like, you know, there could be a bit of room there, hopefully.
Yeah.
So it was primarily an adventure. You know, secondarily, it was nice to sort of, have something exciting to aim for, or a record. So we did that. And that's what really encapsulates what I love about this sport, in a way, and that wasn't a race. You know, there weren't any... We didn't pay anyone. We didn't pay an organization to set things up for us or anything. We just went off and had a little adventure. And it very much is a, you know, trekking meets running, because, you know, we followed a trekking route. Yeah. Of course, you don't run every uphill. You know, we're often trekking up and uphill. We both had trekking poles and many of the same skills, and I never thought of them as skills, that I've learned from trekking were there. And that's simply things like, you know, being able to fuel well, navigation, taking the right kit, putting up with a bit of suffering, just relishing being out in wild places, but often very, you know, windswept and battered places sometimes by the weather, and being a bit tired, but just loving all that. So to me, it was, you know, the perfect combination of those sorts of ways to move, I suppose.
Okay, fantastic. And we'll come back to that a little bit as well. So your first, let's go back. What we want to delve into a little bit is about how you, what you think it is that made you want to run long distances. So half marathon before the toilet experience, you're running, you've always been quite sporty. Did you play football as well?
Yeah, I haven't played for about 5 years now, but at the time, so I was living in Bath and I was probably playing 3 times a week, like five a side. And then I probably would run once a week to keep fit for the football.
Yeah.
So I sort of liked running, but not for its own sake necessarily. Like, you know, so I was definitely, and at weekends with my wife, it's before we had children, we'd often do a walk, a local walk in the Cotswolds, where I grew up.
Yeah.
Yes. So I was, you know, I definitely loved being outdoors, especially in green and lumpy places. Fairly active, fairly sporty. So I don't have, you know, and our sport, the ultra running, is full of people who have amazing stories of coming back from issues, whether it's sort of being overweight or even more sort of extreme things like drug addiction or other addictions, and people or just traumas in their lives. The sport, something about ultra running seems to attract people who have these incredible backstories, and mine's a lot more boring and straightforward. But so I was already quite sporty, but I definitely took to it, you know, in a flash, and thought I just love this.
Why do you think it does attract people? I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, people come to it from all routes, but there does seem to be a way of getting over, perhaps trauma. And a couple of people we've spoken to on this podcast before have said similar things that they find kind of, I don't know whether it's solace, and it's certainly not, you know, pain for pain's sake. It's periods of reflection, but maybe, you know, but it also can be quite social, especially when you're doing events and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of things to pick up from what you've rightly said there. I mean, first of all, I suppose I don't want to make it sound like ultra running is, you know, full of oddballs. you know, there are lots of, it's incredibly friendly community, very supportive, and then full of people doing amazing things. And it's such a positive place. But there's something about, I think I've realized I'm a bit of, I can get obsessed with things. I'm a bit of obsessive.
Yeah.
And I think it does attract people who maybe push things a little further than normal, or, you know, I don't know. I haven't really decided what I think about, you know, the idea of some people have addictive personalities. But it might, you can see how it would attract people to that, because I get obsessed in my training about, you know, I don't know, doing certain miles or just wanting to keep, training hard. It attracts people who want to push beyond where some people might. But there's also the really positive thing about running that I didn't foresee was just how meditative it can be for me, especially, you know, nearly all my running's on off-road, on trails, in green and lumpy places. There's very, you know, I don't think I've had mental health issues, but like I've definitely had stresses in my life, like most people, or times where you just want to run away from it all, pun intended. And you just going for a run sometimes just totally sorts everything out and clears 100%. Your mind and clarifies it, and my best ideas I think come to me when I'm running, although sometimes that idea is run a bit further.
Which is kind of different from road running for me. I've done a couple of road marathons, and training for that, I just found, you know, I can't think of anybody I'd less want to spend 3 hours with than myself on a bleak seafront, you know, in Sussex. But when you are kind of running in the hills and you are, you know, looking at where your feet's going to go, it is meditative. There is something that is, I don't know, uniquely relaxing about it, I think. It's kind of similar to mountain biking in a way, in as much as you're always concentrating on that little bit in front of you.
I think that's really, really important what you just said there, because I think that keeps you in the moment, you know, that Buddhist idea of being present right now. Sure. And what it made me realize was, and so if you're running on roads, yes, sometimes you've got to pause to cross the road or whatever, but you're not necessarily having to think about each foot placement. Whereas if you're on trails, if you're not conscious of that, you may well trip up. And you've got, so you're more likely to stay in the moment. You've got the green, I think it's called the biophilia effect, which means, you know, our innate desire to be in nature, to be in green places.
I just thought it was a Bjork album. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. So you've got that as well. I think I realized that I spent a lot of my time thinking about the past and the future and not thinking enough about right now. So trail running kind of taught me to think about that. Hopefully when I'm not just trail running as well, but definitely when I'm trail running, it does help me with that as well. And I think that feeds into the whole meditative thing. Sure. So I think that's really key. What you just said there.
And then let's flip to a race. So your first ultra that you pitched an article about, and then you kind of had to do it then. Did you go in with trepidation? Did you, you know, sort of feel like the new kid at school, or were you excited? What did that feel like?
I definitely remember feeling very pretty anxious about it, quite daunted, but very excited, you know, excited but mostly daunted. I remember emailing, you know, that I think I only knew two people at the time who had done ultramarathons, so I was emailing them, you know, with all sorts of questions and just for reassurance, I think, more than anything. I remember being very concerned. So it was a 2-day ultramarathon. So I was very concerned about waking up the next morning and how my body would feel, sure. You know, how sore it would be and whether it would even move. You know, I would have run further than I ever had before on the first day, which was, you know, roughly 30 miles or 35 miles, which to me now I know isn't going to, you know, be too much of a problem for me. But at the time it was brand new territory. And I did have a bit of an ankle problem. I'd rolled an ankle on Crib Gok a couple of weeks before. So I did start the race with, I heavily strapped my ankle, which of course changed my gait.
Hang on, an accident on Crib Gok?
Oh, like 2 weeks before the race.
Okay. That could have turned out differently.
Yes. No, I think I actually rolled it on a quite unthreatening piece of it. I think I'd maybe relaxed too much or maybe even jumped down somewhere. And actually, when we'd gone across it...
Like overconfidence to me.
Yeah, probably. And I was actually going across it in... it was the first time across it in a lot of mist. So actually, I couldn't see really the drop-off. So I remember thinking, what's all the fuss about? Right. But no, I have since been across it in the Dragon's Back race and been a lot more, meek, maybe.
Good. So what were those nerves, or what was that kind of trepidation that you felt before kind of doing it? You were worried about how your body would react, I guess, to that amount of time, or actually doing it, or were you worried about the kind of the process of it, the refueling? What was it that
I think I was just wondered whether my body could do it, and whether I'd trained well enough, and because I didn't really know how to train then, and I wouldn't have done a lot of training. Like I remember before, I'd done my first marathon 2 or 3 months earlier, and I doubt I'd run 20 miles again. Maybe I had once. I'm you know, it's a while ago now, but you know, I didn't know how to train. I certainly didn't go out, you know. I probably went out running 3 times a week at the time, which is okay, by the way. But you know, kind of the more you train, the easier it is, obviously. Yeah. So I was worried, but I remember also standing, looking at the other guys, you know, the pros, not literally pros, but the seasoned veterans at the start, and they all had these special packs and these special bottles and these calf guards and these compression wear. And I just remember looking at them thinking, oh my God, they're from a different world. They look like sort of heroes. These sort of superheroes and gods. And I remember thinking, oh, I haven't got any of that kit, and you know, what have I, you know, have I done it all wrong? So I remember being full of doubt and fear, but you know, without sounding like a life coach from Poundland, often, you know, the stuff that puts fear into you is often the stuff you should be sort of should be taking on sometimes.
Sure. And when you were, so after you'd kind of set off, you were going, were there moments where you, was it kind of like, actually, I think I've got this? Or were there, you know, were there kind of peaks and troughs of doubt? Did they kind of continue through the race, or did you learn to deal with them in a different way?
I remember starting with a strategy in my head.
Unbelievable. Sorry.
That's fine. I remember having this idea that people talked about you should walk before you need to, because I think it's accepted in ultramarathons that you're going to hike some bits, especially up hills. So I had this idea that you should hike before you really need to. So 55 minutes in, I thought I'll hike for 5 minutes. But I was doing fine, and I guess in my mind I was still pushing it a bit, like I was probably in the top, 20 early on. And I remember starting to walk, but everyone who passed me said, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" And I thought, I can't be bothered to keep talking to people, like can't be bothered to keep answering this question. So I just carried on running instead, and didn't bother with the walking break.
Sure.
But yeah, I felt okay. When I got to the halfway camp, when the first day was over, I had quite a sore knee, or behind my knee, the top of my hamstring, mm-hmm. sorry, the bottom of my hamstring was very sore because of that bandaged, strapped ankle. So that had changed my gait and give me some soreness there. But the camp had, you could get massages, and it was very social. And I realized a lot of people were doing it for the first time. And I relaxed a bit there, but the next morning, I did feel very stiff and sore, like kind of like never before. But I just sort of thought, well, I'll get going and see. And as I've discovered many times since, is that your body it sort of resists for a bit, but then often just gives in and says, okay, then. And that second day, I remember still wanting to be competitive at it. I think I was in the top 20 again, or at least the top 30, and overall in the race, I finished in the top quarter. So I definitely wanted, even though I had no experience. I wanted to do as well as I possibly could. And the big lesson I remember was the last few miles. I remember just walking. It was finished in the Newcastle city centre by one of the bridges there. Mm-hmm. And I was just walking it in because I just felt like I couldn't run anymore. I was too sore. I probably had a couple of blisters, just tired and sore, and felt there's no way I could run. And then I saw the finish line about a mile ahead.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was running again. And quite, a decent clip. And it amazed me that I could do that my mind had told me I couldn't, yes, I could. And that, I guess that concept, that fascination has stayed with me ever since, of sort of mind versus body, because there probably isn't a line between them. They're part of the same thing, obviously, but it's fascinating, what the mind does and what the body does, and when they work together and when they work against each other.
Do you find that you can understand that a little bit more now you've got more experience? Can you harness that? I mean, I guess you were quite surprised, like, I'm running. It was a surprising moment. Can you now dig into that when you need to?
Yeah, I think I know now that I'm just more useful to the sensations of, I suppose, of soreness or stiffness or those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, it was a brand new sensation, and I wouldn't say, I guess a bit troubling, or a bit, it's just such a new physical experience that I think naturally you're cautious of it. Now, that's very familiar to me. So it probably almost doesn't register in my mind. It's just like, this is what happened. This is how your body feels. This is what happens.
Sure.
So it doesn't sort of hold me back like it did that time, I think. But also, I train a lot very differently now. I'm hopefully stronger and fitter, and therefore those sensations don't come along as readily either. So it's a bit of both.
And how has your training developed over the time? I mean, before it was like, I can run a marathon, I could probably do a bit further, you're keeping it regular. How has that developed over time, I'm looking for tips, frankly.
Well, yeah, I've been quite lucky. I did. I have had some coaches. For my second race, I just sort of bumped into a coach actually at sort of an event, and got him to coach me, for the next race. And that was quite helpful. And then I've worked with three other coaches. So that's definitely helped. And I've got good advice from people. I've fallen in with a dodgy crowd near me called the Bath Bats, who are an informal trail running group. And there's some very experienced people in there, such as Alan Cox and Tim Laney and Alex Copping, who are guys who have helped me early on, give me good advice. But I think the overall, and it seems obvious, but the overall thing is kind of the more you run, the better you get at it.
Yeah.
But you need to, you need to do that gradually, so that you're not getting, injured or fatigued or divorced.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's it. There is that balance. And you suggested you've got kids as well, and it's finding finding the time to do it as well is, and kind of balancing that with the rest of your life is when you, you know, when you're not pro, is hard.
It is. I mean, I found I really want to train. I really want to run. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't bother me to get up at six at all. Sometimes I get up at five. That's not, you know, it's a struggle for 10 minutes, but it's not, you know, mentally I don't find the idea of getting up at five too daunting. Occasionally I've even got up at four or even earlier to do a, you know, to get a long run in, especially when my kids were younger. So it kind of comes down to how much you want it in a way. So I've got, you know, the more I've progressed, the more the sense of reward is there. And the reward could be, you know, it's different for everyone and success is different for everyone. Yeah. But I've definitely tasted what I consider to be success and I want more of it, okay. I suppose. So it's not too much of a... So I'm willing to, and I'm willing to, you know, I've got no social life. That's why I'm so talkative now.
I mean, what do you define as success? What do you think have been your most successful moments in ultra running?
There was definitely a big turning point when, early 2016, there was a race. It was the Highland Fling, which is a 53-mile race in Scotland, mm-hmm. and it was named the British Athletics Ultra Trail UK Championships.
Okay.
And I only found out about it late in the day, but I was really fit at the time, and it was the first time I really paced a race well. Because it's obviously it's a, you know, like any race, even at 5 or 10K, it's sometimes difficult to get that pacing spot on. Especially when, yeah, the longer the race, the more difficult it is because it's easier to, yeah, go out hard and misjudge it.
Sure.
But we're all trying to be the fastest tortoise in a way. I got that one spot on, well, almost spot on, and I placed second, which was a big surprise.
Blimey.
Okay. I think to me and probably to a lot of people, but that earned me a GB vest. Later that year, so that was kind of a big turning point for me. Before then, I did the Spine Race twice, which is a very different type of race.
Yeah.
And I got on the podium. I placed third there, which again, well, I suppose I was fourth the year before, so in a way, it wasn't a surprise. But it surprised me a lot when I was fourth.
Yeah.
But again, that sort of race, the Spine Race, is going on as we talk, actually. But that is another race that combines the sort of long distance walking mindset with running, in that you're just not going to run all that distance, obviously. Sure. So it's a lot of those skills. That was a big turning point. And then I've become later that, yeah, around that time, I became obsessed with a race called Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc, UTMB, which is, I don't know how much you know about that one, but 105-mile circuit in the French Alps.
Yeah.
And really, for the 100-mile distance, that's the biggest one in the world. Like, all the top guys.
All the, you know, big Killian guys are there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, American.
Yeah.
He's been there the last 2 years. And so I've done that 4 years in a row, and I guess I've progressed from 29th to fifth place last year, which I felt
is unbelievable. I mean...
Well, you're kind. I feel a bit like Jeremy Corbyn after the last election, where like I sort of am acting like I won it and people are sort of treating me like I won it, but really I didn't win it. But it felt fantastic. I didn't really imagine in my mind that I could get fifth. I was just trying to get into the top 10.
And of course people can watch a film about it.
There is a little film doing the rounds.
Underdog.
Mutual friends. Yeah, Matt and Ellie from Summit Fever Media. It's called Underdog.
It's brilliant.
And they very
brilliant.
Kindly, yeah, earlier in the year they had identified that they thought that was a nice, that was a good story for them to want to turn into a little film. And they worked very hard on that. It won an award at the Kendall Mountain Festival. And they, it was kind of not lucky, but it added some pressure, but also kept me honest in that I knew if I didn't do well, even though they said it didn't really matter how my race went, because there'd still be a story for them. Obviously, it was a much better story if I did well.
Yeah. Did they have the name first?
Sorry, say that again.
Did they have the name of the film first? It's going to be called Underdog. This is what's going to happen. You have to place at least sixth.
I keep banging on about, but at the time anyway, I've tried to let it go now, but I would bang on about how I'm older than most of those guys. I'm not professional, whereas most of them are. I've got children and most of them don't. Most of them live in or train in mountains.
Yeah.
Most of them, a lot of them had sort of sub 220 marathons,
yeah.
Which is mine's a 238.
Right.
So I'm not. Yeah, I'm old, an old parent who can't run very fast. So, my mountains are the Cotswolds. So, yeah. I guess I've over-egged that a little bit sure. Because the year before I was 12th, so I was close.
Yeah.
But that seemed like a word hopefully encapsulated that. One or two people have called us out on it on social media and said I wasn't really an underdog, but you know that's it's a neat little title.
It certainly is. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 43.
43. Okay. That's not old. I'm 42. It's all good. and then, okay. So let's. I mean that was a remarkable achievement. Do you think that? How much of this is a natural ability? By that I mean not necessarily talent, but a few things about your physiology coming together and your mindset coming together. Do you think that if you were to say, if you were to identify somebody who would be a good ultra runner, do you fulfill some of that criteria?
Good question. I never really thought about that. I guess I've always been sporty, but I don't think when it comes to running, I don't think I'm an obvious good athlete in that. I work a lot with Shane Benzi from Running Reborn, who's a technique expert, and I say I work a lot with him. That's because I never really get it right, okay. And my technique isn't very good. I don't have a huge VO2 max. I've had that tested. Yeah. It's kind of average, really. So I don't have, and again, like marathon running. If I really concentrated on marathons, or maybe had a few years ago when I was younger, maybe I'd get down close to 230, maybe. But I was I'm never going to get to 220. And even then, you know, that's not going to win me a lot. You've got to be sub 220. You've got to get a, like sort of 215 to be world class, you know. So I'm a long way from that, for example. But in terms of being out in the hills, being, you know, in lumpy places and happy to do that for 24 hours or several days on end,
yeah.
I think in a way to people who know me, like, so my wife used to say that my idea of fun isn't the same as most people's idea of fun, which kind of means, yeah, that I seem to enjoy being out in places, beautiful places, but they might be a bit challenging and they might be a bit uncomfortable at times if you're out there for a long time.
Yeah.
So that aspect of my personality, I think, has been there for a long time. But the sport, the more athletic side of it isn't as obvious or as fine tuned or as good, I suppose.
Okay,
well, if that answers your question.
Yeah, sure. Are you competitive? I mean, are you racing against yourself? Or are you racing against others? Do you want to win, or do you just want to do better for yourself?
Lots of people in running. One of the great things about the sport is you can literally just race yourself, kind of, course or on a similar distance. But I definitely love racing other people. I love that about the sport. I'm much more excited about placing. In a couple of weeks, I've got a local trail race here, just where I am in Wiltshire.
I bet they see your name on the list and they're like, oh God, why did you have to live down here?
Well, that's the thing. I've only ever placed, I think I was fourth or fifth last year, and I've only ever placed second, but it's right on my doorstep. I should win it, you know.
Yeah.
But there's always two or three faster youngsters.
Right.
Yeah. It's a nine mile race, so I always claim I'm, you know, it doesn't suit me because it's so short. But
sure.
I want to win it. I'm not that interested in racing. When I'm racing it, I'm not looking at my watch, looking at the time. I'm trying to catch the guy ahead. So I'm more excited, or girl. I'm more excited about that sort of primal contest between people, especially in the second half of the race, than times, really. So I do love racing other people. Yeah, I find that really exciting. But sometimes you get wonderful, especially on these longer races like UTMB and these long ultras, you get wonderful camaraderie with people. It's not at UTMB this year, last year, you know, I was the people I was running with things that I was often, we were chatting and being very friendly and even helping each other a little bit. You know, it's not all hard-nosed, you know, it's all about me and I don't care about anyone else. There's a really nice camaraderie sometimes.
Sure, sure. And what keeps you going?
But I do want to win.
So what happens when there's nobody to beat, like in the Kate Rath adventure? I mean, that was, what kind of motivated you throughout that when things were getting hard, or are you just one of those people who kind of everything's brilliant kind of fast show, it's all wonderful?
I do wonder whether Beth thinks I was a bit two-faced in that I was probably being a bit morose at times, and then we might see Matt and Ellie who would film us intermittently,
and then a big grin would come across your face.
Yeah, and because I know them so well, and they're really good friends of mine. I was at their wedding, you know,
right.
And so I would just think I'm seeing friends. I'd feel happy and chatty,
yeah.
And I wonder, you know, Beth never said anything, but I wonder if she kind of thought, hold on, he was, you know, he's putting it all on for the cameras.
We'll ask her in an upcoming episode.
Yeah, the outtakes. Yeah, they are known for doing their outtakes. So yeah, I wasn't happy all the way through that. I definitely had moments of sullenness and occasional self-pity.
Yeah.
I guess with that one, yeah, physically you don't have someone to race, so I might have been slightly less motivated, and it was slightly more relaxing and enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But I guess we sort of had the previous fastest known time to race against, but that isn't as motivating to me. I'm more excited by there's a guy, he's only 20 minutes ahead. Sorry, guy or girl.
Yeah.
Or there's a guy or girl catching me, you know, get a move on. That's a bit more exciting, but it's nice to do both, to be honest. It's nice to do both.
Sure, sure. And, okay, so how the Cape Wrath Trail, why did you choose to do that one in particular? Or you know, was it the fact that, I don't know how to put this, that there was an achievable fastest known time, or you know, was it, you know, the combination of that, and also it's an area of the country that you wanted to explore and you wanted a bit of an adventure?
It was more that it's seen as very remote and very tough.
Yeah.
I suppose there's a little bit of debate which I quite enjoy, of, you know, which is our toughest trail in Britain, like, you know, and I've done a guidebook, as I say, for the Pennine Way, which has a reputation as perhaps our toughest national trail, although I've also run the Southwest Coast Path, and that's incredibly tough. Cracky. And long. So in my mind, it's those two or the Cape Wrath. So I was thinking, well, maybe that one's, if not, you know, as tough, if not tougher.
Yeah.
So there was some curiosity. I guess that sounds almost a bit matched. I didn't mean it quite like that, in that also it's for the beauty and the scenery. So I keep hearing how Cape Wrath was really remote, so that was really exciting, and to really get away from it all and see that part of Scotland, because I hadn't been that far up in Scotland. I'd been to the Torridon region, Torridon and Ullapool. I've been around there for 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't seen the rest, you know, and there's that whole load of Scotland north of, you know, Fort William and the Glencoe region that a lot of us don't really get to, because it's quite far from where I am.
Sure.
So it was, you know, more than anything, it was to explore a part of Britain that I heard was wild and beautiful and rugged, but it was a long way away. And that gives you a good reason to go and do it. The record thing came afterwards, in that we thought, oh, let's look up the record and see what it is, and see, you know, and it was like, oh, okay, well, it's, you know, it's maybe something we could beat. So that added some excitement to it, but that wasn't the primary thing. It was more about exploring Britain's wilder places was the main.
But a lot of the press afterwards focused on that fastest known time, FKT. Was that, I mean, I guess that didn't bother you, even though that wasn't your primary objective. It's still, I mean, we're both journalists. It's a good hook, isn't it?
Yeah. I no complaints at all. I mean, that was still, you know, that kept us, I may be being a little bit mischievous. I mean, that kept us, like, we didn't sleep a whole lot, and we forced each other up, you know, at uncomfortable times of the morning to get on with it. So we were, you know, we were definitely keen to set a record. So we pushed ourselves. So I guess, it's pleasing if that's recognised. But I suppose I just wanted to, just stress the other point as well, that, you know, we could go and set a record, you know, maybe on a road somewhere, or, you know, or something. But that wouldn't, I can't speak for Beth, but that wouldn't have excited me much. Like, for example, I'm incredible. I'm a big fan of an ultra runner called Dan Lawson, who tried to break the record last year of the, which way did he go? He went John O'Groats to Land's End, all on the roads. So there's a record there of around a week to run it. And he tried to break that. He got pretty close. But to me, and that's just phenomenal. And something like a week-long run to me sounds pretty exciting. But that's all on road. So I can't imagine I'd ever go for that because I just don't want to spend that lying on tarmac. It hurts.
yeah, for sure. Let's talk a bit about Beth. How do you, I mean, you do a lot of your ultra running. I imagine you do a lot of your training on your own. If you're racing like the UTMB and the Spine Race, you're on your own. What is the different dynamic of, you know, picking a partner and doing it with someone? I mean, two questions. What's an ideal partner? And then the second question is, how does that change the dynamic when you're running?
Yeah, you've got to be careful picking a partner, haven't you? Because you know, it's, you're both going to get very, very tired. You're both very reliant on each other because you can only move as well as the slowest person is moving. Mm-hmm. So you've got to pick very wisely. And luckily, kind of I or we did. I think it was a joint decision actually. Like I think Matt and Ellie had met her when at the Spine Race in 2015 when I'd met her. And obviously been very impressed. She had won the women's race and finished fourth overall and in a very, very good time. So we knew she was strong. We knew her a bit. But I think often someone's personality is really important. So luckily, I'd run two or three days of that with her or close to her.
Right.
So I guess I knew what she was like in that she's, you know, when you're running something like this, if I'm honest, she's kind of fairly quiet and keeps herself to herself, really, but is very focused and very tough and just gets on with it in a way. So in a way, I didn't, you know, when you're, and I think we knew each other well enough and knew the sport in a way well enough that, you know, if someone's a bit quiet, it's not necessarily the time to just start peppering them with questions about how they are and, I don't know, what they're missing from home or, you know, in a way, just leaving each other alone is the thing to do. And I think, anyway, I mean, she might be sitting there going, "That bastard, he never once asked how I am."
Was doing.
and you know, out of interest, you know, I remember listening to a podcast where someone was explaining, in America, often in races, they have a pacer, someone who can run some of the race with the runner,
right,
which isn't really done in Britain so much. But I remember listening to someone's advice on that, and it was to actually not ask the person how they were doing, because you don't want to be internalizing, you don't want to be thinking about yourself too much, you want to be distracting yourself and enjoying the scenery and so on to distract from any discomfort. So we did actually ask each other sometimes, you know, how are you doing, but not very much. And I actually think that's the way to do it. You know, you want to try and distract. Not be thinking. If you've got discomfort, you don't want to be thinking about it all the time.
Sure. My only experience of doing that is doing the original mountain marathon, the OM, with my best mate. And it was fine when the peaks and troughs were exact opposite. So one would lift the other. But occasionally, though, those troughs would come along at the same time. And then it seemed to, well, you said that way. but it was very rare. But yeah, I did notice that, you know, as long as you're not in sync too much, almost, in terms of how you're feeling, then that kind of helps. I don't know if that's something you experience. I mean, that's my only very, very limited experience in it. But
that's exactly it. I think you both know you're going to have ups and downs. And therefore you, I mean, yeah, my thought was, you know, also, I mean, at one point, well, in an early time when she wasn't feeling as good as I was, I think I tried to say something encouraging or complimentary, and actually it just sounded a bit patronizing. And I thought, but I won't try and say something like that again. But other than that, like, you're right. You're both going to have ups and downs, and it's unlikely actually that they're going to sink that much. So I think you just got to be kind and patient and things like that. And she's probably again sitting there thinking that git wasn't like that at all. But I mean, I was definitely, you know, I definitely had spells of being morose and I wouldn't say, I don't know about sulky, but, you know, sullen and just a bit fed up and quiet. And I definitely, I got quite down because actually I was starting under the naive idea that I would get back to see my kids in the nativity play.
Right.
That turned out that wasn't going to be likely. And that really got me down. And that was totally my own fault and stuff. Yeah. And actually, we delayed the attempt by a day because it was the river crossings were really high, up to 2 meters possibly. Okay. So it made sense from a safety perspective to start a day later. But that actually meant I wouldn't get back for the nativity, although I still started out for the first 2 days thinking it was possible.
Yeah.
So we had that kind of extra tension of me being quite keen to get back, and she didn't have a deadline like that, but she was very good about it. And actually, yeah, when I realized it wasn't possible, yeah, for an hour or two I was really fed up and really cross with myself for, you know, being a bad parent. And then when it was definitely gone, I think I felt better after that, actually.
Yeah,
that
sure.
It was gone. We couldn't chase it. But
I think the idea is not to have those. I mean, it can be those little things, those little niggles or those focus points psychologically that become kind of built up over time. When it's kind of a multi-day race or, you know, ultras, then you can't become fixated on them. You need to,
I guess, get
over absolutely. Them quite quickly. Otherwise, that becomes reasons for not doing so well, I guess.
Yes, yeah, and that's a trick, a mental, I guess, process, to use an overused word, that I'm still working out sometimes. Yeah, something about a race can niggle you early on and annoy you, and you can really cling to it. So it's important to try and let things go, I think, if you can.
Yeah.
But the whole mental side of it just fascinates me. I mean, hopefully, mostly I get it right, but not always. And it's a fascinating side to these sorts of activities.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and last question, what's 2019 got in store? It's January, where as we record this, have you made any New Year's resolutions? Have you set yourself some ridiculous goals? Have you pitched an article that is unachievable, but you're going to have to do it anyway?
Well, I don't know. I haven't made any resolutions. I'm not, other than don't bother doing any more races dressed as a toilet,
which is a general good advice in life, I would say.
If I can give anyone any advice in the world,
the one thing I've learned over all these years,
do you know what? I don't even have the world record for it or anything. Like, that's what I should have done.
Oh, you'd be in the Guinness Book of Records.
Yeah, and then it's kind of worthwhile. You'd have that. I noticed someone else on Twitter going on about it, and I checked in with him and said, "What was your time?" And he beat me, you know, quite well. So,
right. Well, maybe that's some, one for 2020.
Yes. But yeah, I had a wonderful year of running last year. It was my best year yet. So I just feel very glad to still be healthy and fit and, supported by people. And I'm very lucky now. Several people have started approaching me for coaching, and that's really taken off. I'm doing coaching a lot of people now, and really enjoy that. And if you don't mind me plugging something quickly, my good friend Shane Benzie, the running technique expert I mentioned earlier, we're doing a couple of courses in March and May this year that will aimed at helping people get around ultra marathons such as UTMB. The information's on my social media, but the races I've so far.
I see an article decided, coming up. Yep.
Yeah. Might just be. I'm doing Trans Gran Canaria in the end of February.
Wow.
Which is, as the name hints, is a race across Gran Canaria, 79 miles and a fair bit of climb, which is kind of like a sort of a 2/3 UTMB. So it should suit me quite well.
Yeah.
Although it's so early in the year, I don't know how good I'll be feeling at that point, but we'll see. Uh-huh. It's quite soon. And then my dream still is to get into Western States, which is a 100-mile race in America, but it's very difficult to get into. But
right.
I've got one chance for this year in April. I'm going to go and do like a race over there, and if I get in the top two, then I get a place at Western States. So I'm going to gamble on that and try and do that.
Right. Wow.
And then towards the end,
yeah,
it's going to be interesting. I have to run fast, which I'm not really good at. I like going up and down. But in September, there's a big race called the UTMR, just around the corner from UTMB. It's the Ultra Tour Monte Rosa, Lizzie Hawker's race in the Alps, Swiss Alps. 105 miles, which should really suit me and should be really, it's really spectacular and quite tough. And I'll really look forward to doing that as well. So at the moment, they're kind of my three main races. And then hopefully we are discussing, Beth and I and the others, maybe another FKT later this year, if not next year. We really enjoyed doing that on Cape Wrath. Yeah. So we're looking for ideas and holes in our calendars to do something similar again. So yeah, that's what I'm looking at, and just hoping to be, you know, fit and healthy for the year. Really, that's the number one goal, and to keep enjoying it, I suppose.
Brilliant. Excellent. Damien Hall, thank you very much for joining us and sharing all that. Yeah, really fascinating stuff. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Massive thanks to Damien. We'll be catching up with the stuff that he's got planned for the year. Sounds really interesting. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review wherever you get it from. And we'll be back next month.